The Accidental Entrepreneur is brought to you through our affiliate relationships with the following sponsors: Digital Accelerant, the digital mobile business card that generates leads. Text the word LAW to 21,000 to get connected and learn how to get your own digital business card. And by Fetch Internet and Fetch Pro, the secure high-speed app that eliminates the need to pay for hotspots or use public unsecure Wi-Fi. And Printify, the online on-demand print shop for all your corporate merchandise. Be sure to visit our online store and get your own podcast merch. Listen to all of our sponsors' commercials later in this episode and follow their links in the show notes to learn more about their products and services.
When it's cold outside, you know, my wife will say to our five-year-old boy, put your mittens on. Of course, you know, that's the parental thing, right? You want their hands to be warm. You don't want them to get frostbite. But of course, a little five-year-old boy is defiant. And he says, no. Right. And the prof said, when I would approach him, I'd say, oh, it's cold outside. Are you going to wear your red mittens or your blue? And that little boy would go, blue. And,
right. Because you give him a choice of not doing, but which one do you want to do, right?
Yeah. And it's such a simple thing. But I would say the majority of parents never do that. They tell their kids what to do. Or rather than giving, you know, structured choices when they wake up, like, hey, what do you want to do today? Do you want to go to the library for reading? Would you like to go to a movie? Or do you want to go over to the mall? Whatever. And they'll usually choose one of those three. But if they just wake up and you go, what do you want to do today? And they go, I want to go to Disney World. No, we're not going to Disney World.
Right. Now you're already negative. Right. Yeah. Definitely parents are not good at persuading their children because they don't feel they have to, right? Do you feel like, well, your kid ever say to you, well, why? Like, it doesn't make sense to them. And you're like, because I'm the parent.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a good answer to your kid.
and unfortunately, that bleeds into what we do at work. And so one of the other principles that I talk about is called consistency, which says we feel this internal psychological pressure, but also external social pressure to be consistent in what we say and what we do.
The information provided in these episodes is for entertainment purposes only. It is not a guarantee of success or to be construed as advice of any kind. You should always seek advice from local licensed professionals before making any decisions.
The dictionary defines an entrepreneur as a person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially a business, usually with considerable initiative and risk. People often start a business without much choice, perhaps due to a job loss or just being dissatisfied at work. And they come up with an idea they just know can be successful. They become entrepreneurs by accident. That is to say, their success or failure happens by accident, not with intention. My name is Mitch Beinhacker. I'm a corporate attorney and a business advisor. You're listening to The Accidental Entrepreneur, my podcast about how to achieve success on purpose, not by accident. Join me along with our monthly guests where we share our knowledge and help you get a hold of your business. And now on to today's episode. Just to remind you, the podcast is produced and brought to you by my legal practice, Beinhacker Law. We provide business and estate services to entrepreneurs, inventors, and other small business owners. Whether you're just getting started or you've been operating for a long time, contact us for all your general legal needs, from contracts to client agreements, from purchasing a new location to onboarding a new partner or key employee. We draft all types of agreements and handle most business transactions. For more information about our products and services, visit beinhackerlaw.com or you can follow our link in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's interview.
Hi, I'm Brian Ahern, Chief Influence Officer at Influence People, and I specialize in teaching individuals and organizations the science of influence and how to apply that in everyday situations to get to better results.
All right, Brian, thanks for coming on the show. For those of you watching the video, very thankful to Brian. He set up a little background there with our logo. Our cover art has changed. I told you that, but that was one that I particularly liked. So I appreciate it very much. And thanks for coming on the show. I think it was Frank Agent that connected us.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And you live in Columbus, which is where I told you I spent. It was a long time ago. It was 20 years ago in a house for about 19 months on Piedmont Road in Clintonville.
Yep. Very familiar with Clintonville. Lots of friends who lived there. And my mom lives just almost in Clintonville.
Okay. So we were back when my son and I were visiting schools with my wife to see Ohio State. And then we went by the house and it would look like this had been 20 years, right? It looked like a time warp, like nothing had ever happened to this house. It was the same color. The driveway looked the same. There was a trellis that we left in the back that morning glories would grow up in the morning. It was still there. It was like nothing had changed. So it was funny. They weren't home. The people weren't home. So
it's a quaint little area, and you're right. It doesn't change a whole lot.
Yeah. Yeah. But I appreciate you putting the time aside this morning to come on and talk to me about all the influencing that you do and the teaching you do for people. But maybe we can go back a little bit to, you know, where you're from originally, where you grew up, maybe in Columbus all your life. I don't know. And then take us up to how you developed everything that you're doing now with people.
Okay. Well, great. I've lived a pretty interesting life. I was born in Honolulu, Hawaii. My father was serving in the Marines during Vietnam. And then we moved back to New York, where they were originally from, my parents. And then it was out to Connecticut for 4 years, and then back to, out to California, and then to Connecticut, then to Ohio. And I've lived in Ohio the vast majority of my life. So I consider Ohio to be home. I attended Miami University, which is in Southwest Ohio. Got a business degree, fell into the insurance industry. You know, nobody really goes to school and goes, man, I can hardly wait to get into insurance. But it turned out to be an awesome career. And through that journey, and I was involved with sales training, I came across the material of a man named Dr. Robert Cialdini, who's the most cited living social psychologist on the planet when it comes to the science and psychology of influence and persuasion. And I started utilizing it in all the training I was doing. And then 2.5 years ago, left my corporate role to pursue this full time.
So you were in-house with with some of the insurance companies, or?
Yes. Columbus is a big insurance town.
Yeah, nationwide.
State Auto Insurance, right. Motorist, Nationwide, Grange, they're all headquartered here. And I worked for the company State Auto Insurance. And I was doing internal sales training for like our field salespeople, and eventually started doing some external training with insurance agents. And all of it revolved around the psychology that I teach.
Okay, great. So I'm glad I asked. So did you move around a lot because of your dad's involvement in the military, or no, that wasn't?
It really, I mean, he was obviously out in Hawaii for the military, but once he got out, it was back to New York because that's where his family was from. And then a lot of the moves were just, you know, way back in the day, you know, moving cross country to take the next level position with your company wasn't a big deal. And it wasn't the kind of thing that a guy went home to his spouse or kids and say, hey, I got this opportunity. What do you think? It was, nope. Hey, we're moving.
Right. Right. And,
it was good because it helped me be a little more outgoing, because I was going to a new school every year up through like 7th or 8th grade.
Right, right, right. I think kids, you know, parents are always like, oh, we're going to disrupt the kids. I think kids bounce pretty high. And when you see the world through an eyes that, oh, it's not so small, maybe it makes you more confident in terms of how you deal with people. So let's get into then the stuff that you're doing now, your business, mm-hmm. right? And how you work with people. I'm curious because there seems to be like different people get into different things because they have an epiphany in life, or I don't know, somebody introduces you to somebody or a book or whatever. We were talking off mic about that with our children. How did you come across, you mentioned the author, what's his name?
Robert Cialdini.
Okay. So how did you come across him? Was it somebody who said, hey, you got to read this guy?
It was someone who had worked in the sales department for a period of time. And then she moved on to another department, but she was studying for her master's at Ohio State. She came down and gave a video to my boss and I, and she said, I think you guys are going to really like this. And she understood right away, as Robert Cialdini presenting at Stanford, talked about the psychology, about how it could help us in the sales area. And Mitch, when I watched the video, right away, the light bulb came on. I thought, the psychology he's talking about, it is the foundation of all selling. It's why certain approaches work and certain don't. It explained it all. I was really intrigued by the fact that everything he talked about was research-based. This wasn't a, you know, motivational speaker getting up there and trying to, you know, just get your juices flowing or tell you right. What he or she did. This was based on empirical data. And I'm a logical person. I thought I can get behind that. And the third thing was, he was very clear about his stance on ethics, that we can do this in a non-manipulative way. And that appealed to the moral part of me. And so for that reason, I started using the video in a lot of training, and people, it just resonated. People found it fascinating. When they would utilize what I was teaching, they saw immediately they were having more success. And I just became so intrigued by it that I found myself continually reading about it and then working on ways to share it with people. And I just knew shortly after that, this is what I'll do with the rest of my career. And here I am doing it now.
Right. Because it made sense. I think that's it's not a myth, or that's the misnomer about sales, right? It's not a process of trying to manipulate somebody, get them to buy something that maybe they don't need or don't want. Mm-hmm. That's the Tin Men used car salesman, you know, kind of view that people have of sales. But, you know, a good salesperson is really somebody who educates you and teaches you and helps you make the decision that you should be making, right?
Yeah, we talk about informing somebody into yes and using the psychology to bring forth the benefits of what you're offering or the downsides if they don't take advantage of what you're offering, so that you can more clearly show that the product that I have here, if I've done my job well and I've, you know, gone through the qualification and I know then, Mitch, that what I have to offer will be beneficial for you. Right. Then it really becomes a matter of how do I communicate that to you? And most people never, ever study what it takes to ethically influence people. And say stumble through life, you know, sometimes they make a sale, sometimes they don't, but they never really know why. And we can help them understand how.
So how long were you using these techniques with the company you were with?
Mm-hmm. I was introduced to Robert Cialdini's material, I think it was 2003. So it's going on 20 years. And then as I began to utilize the information, it was 2008 when I got certified by him to start.
There's a process. I was going to ask you that.
Yep. So okay. There's only 20 of us in the world. There's a principle called scarcity. People value things more when they think they're rare or going away. And he practices that. He is very particular about who will represent him in his life's work. And so there's only 20 of us around the world who are certified to teach. And I'm very fortunate. I'm the only person in the insurance industry.
Yeah. I mean, I'm big in sales and motivation and read. I've never heard of him. So in all honesty, I just haven't, but I'll have to read about him when we're off. When we're done with this. So there's a methodology of sales training materials that you've developed over time or that come out of his training or both?
Well, a combination. So Robert Cialdini introduced what he calls the principles of persuasion. After about a 3-year hiatus from his teaching, this goes way back into the late 1970s, I believe. He took a 3-year hiatus. He went out. He was getting jobs where he knew people whose livelihood depended on their ability to persuade others. He wanted to learn from their training and see how the best people operated. And then he stepped back and with his background in social psychology, analyzed everything that he was learning and said, you know, we can pretty much put everything into these categories of human behavior that he called the principles of influence. So he teaches those and talks about those in depth. My skill set, Mitch, is understanding that psychology, but also seeing how to apply it. And again, my background being insurance, very good at applying it through the insurance process. But what I did was then I looked at the sales. With my sales background, I looked at the sales process from beginning with marketing and prospecting all the way through getting referrals and which of this psychology is most effective at each of those stages and what are examples? How does it look like when you apply it? So that the people who go through my workshops or read my books, they can clearly go, okay, not only do I understand this fascinating science, but I see how I can apply it in the things that I'm doing.
Right. Well, because that's really where it, you know, the rubber meets the road, especially in the insurance business. You're selling something that very often is intangible, especially if it's like life and disability and things like that. And nobody wants it. They have to have it. Sometimes Yep. They want it and they can't get it. And it's difficult. And it's definitely you know, you can't sit them inside the car and turn the engine on and let them smell the leather. It just doesn't work that way.
And then on top of it, it's the one thing that you don't really want to buy it. You feel forced to because maybe the state says you have to.
Yeah.
And then once you get it, you never want to use it because even though you may have great insurance coverage, it's something bad has happened.
Right.
And nobody wants that. So, yeah, you have a lot working against you. But what I will say too, Mitch, is I was really proud to be a part of the insurance industry. And I say was because I'm not officially with an insurance company or an agency. But at the end of the day, insurance does two things. One, we help people. You know, if God forbid something happens to you, you're hoping you have a good agent with a reputable company and the right coverages. And if you do, you're saying, thank God that I have this coverage to help me get back on my feet.
Right.
The other thing that we do too, and people don't think about this, is we help the economy. Because who's going to loan you a bunch of money to buy a car or buy a home or start a business if you can't guarantee that you will repay it if something bad happens? And when the insurance industry steps in, well, that frees the banks up to loan more money, more businesses are started, and there's this ripple effect throughout the economy.
Sure. Even when you look at like natural disasters or, you know, hurricanes or whatever, it's really the insurance companies that are now pouring money into the local economies to rebuild. And
yep.
You know, it's not, I mean, yeah, we couldn't live without the insurance industry. You don't have as an individual or a family unit, let's say, things that happen will wipe you out. You just can't, you know, deal with that on your own. Mm-hmm. So you have to deal with it collectively, which is an insurance company. Basically, yep. People getting together and putting money in a pot and saying, hey, I don't know if I need this now, but you might. So let's all put money together. That's really right. Where the concept came from. So I also want to talk about your book, because I'm sure that's based on all of the principles that you teach and you go through. But maybe, and I told you that I would leave it to you to kind of take us through some of the principles, share some stories, some success stories you've found with people that have changed the way that they do things and how they're more successful now.
Sure. So I've got two books out right now. The first book that came out about a year and a half ago is called Influence People, with the subtitle Powerful Everyday Opportunities to Persuade That Are Lasting and Ethical. And for people who might not catch that, the word people, that's the acronym. And I really, you know, in all the years that I was teaching this, I saw even when people would maybe go through a workshop and they leave, they still struggled some about how do I apply this? So my book takes Cialdini's work and in very layman's terms talks about the principles. And then we look at, you know, some of the decision making that humans have. And then it went into business case studies, actual business examples that I saw when I was working with the insurance company, utilizing it maybe in your social media. And then there was kind of a catch-all, you know, just for other things that didn't fall neatly in there. But that book is got short, you know, like 3 to 5 page chapters, very short, practical application where somebody could read it and go, that makes sense. And I'll give you one quick example. There's a principle called social proof that we are, we often look to other people to figure out what we should do in certain situations. You know, when you're raising kids, we call it peer pressure. There are very simple ways to utilize that ethically in the business place to get more people to do something. And one chapter I wrote about, there was a friend named Jim who worked in the IT area, sent me an email, looked kind of complicated, to a non-IT guy. Right. So I did what most people would do, which was nothing. I filed it away. And then he followed up and he said, hey, are you finished with this? And I felt a little bad because he's a good guy. He was my friend. So I get the email back out and I follow his instructions, and it was actually really easy. So I replied to everybody and I said, all done. That was easy. And then he did what most people would do. He replied right back to me. So I called him up and I said, Jim, is everybody finished? And he said, no, John out in Indianapolis, he's the last one. There was like half a dozen of us. So I quickly explained the social proof and the kind of the pressure of the crowd. And I said, hit the reply all button so that he knows everybody else is done and he'll feel that pressure. So he did it. And 7 minutes later, the guy replies, consider me among those who've completed the tasks. For Jim, that was gold. Check it off, move to the next thing. So there is so much opportunity to take this psychology in even the most minute things that we do and think about it differently and communicate differently to get more people doing what we need them to do.
Right. Yeah. There's no question that people see other people doing things, and good, bad, or indifferent, they tend to, to do things. You know, sometimes if everyone's doing something, you got to question, is it just the group and people are saying, oh, well, you know, Brian's doing it, and Mitch is doing it, and John's doing it, and Mike's doing it. I guess we should be doing it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's good and bad, right? Sometimes people don't evaluate something for themselves.
Yes.
They're just going with the crowd.
These principles that we talk about really have helped humans survive over the course of history, right? If you know, like, and trust somebody, you are more likely to follow their lead, right?
Right.
And usually that works out well. If everybody's doing something, usually that works out well. But there are times where it doesn't. There are times where I may know, like, and trust somebody, but when I ask their opinion on something, they have no expertise
right
in what they're doing, right? You're an attorney. If I asked a friend who wasn't an attorney and they give me some advice, it's not going to be nearly as good as the advice that you would offer because you've studied that. So sometimes we do just default to, well, I'll ask my best friend.
Right. They have no expertise. Yeah.
So what I tell people is generally these principles guide us into good behavior. And that's why they continue to exist, because they helped us as a species exist. If following the crowd always went wrong, we would have learned to stop that long ago.
Right.
We might have been just gone out of existence.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we would all feel that we had to make our own decisions and we couldn't have other people's input. That wouldn't help people survive. That's for sure.
And there's a lot of one-offs too, where people will tell me like, I don't follow the crowd. Nothing great ever happened by following the crowd. And I say, you know what? No argument there in terms of medical breakthroughs mean breaking away from conventional thinking, new technologies, breaking away from.
But innovation is not as common as people think it is. It's not, it's usually the other way, like you said.
And I tell people too, I said, during the course of your day, how many things are you trying to do that are going to be breakthrough, or do you just want to get home sometimes and the traffic's backed up and you see people getting off the highway and you don't even have to do anything other than, you know, you better get off the highway. Follow the crowd right away.
Yeah.
And then they start realizing, I guess I follow the crowd more than I thought I did.
Right. Well, it helps. It does. It helps survival. It helps survival. Yeah. And I'm reading, I have another guy coming on with another book in a couple of months, and I'm going to have to read his book too. It's called Never Go With Your Gut. And you know, it looks at the psychology of the fact that a lot of people do make, you know, those blink decisions.
Yes.
And, you know, generally that's not a good thing to do. So you do have to take in the empirical data and say, okay, what are other people doing? And if, you know, if 300 people bought this mattress, let's say, right? Because sleeping's a big deal. But only two people bought this other one that sounds like a good prop. You know, maybe you ought to figure out why people are doing this versus this, and not just say, well, I don't know, that seemed good to me. And people do that. So I think, you know.
You'll have a very interesting conversation. I know Gleb, the author of that book, and you'll have, he's a Columbus guy too. We met at an event about a year and a half
ago. Very interesting guy.
Very smart. Yeah.
Yeah. Very smart. Very smart. So, but I think that's true because a lot of the popular thinking is, you know, like, yeah, just how do you feel about it? And unfortunately, that's why the divorce rate is 50%, because in relationships, it's all emotional and we make these terrible decisions, not based on a methodology of what you're looking for and what this person's looking for. And because that's what we do in business, right? We don't just wing it. Well, some people do, unfortunately. That's why the podcast came about. But in relationships, so people just, you know, it's how they feel and they're all excited and they're attracted to this person and that doesn't last forever, we know, right? So if you're not compatible and you're not a good team, half of the time doesn't work out. So yeah, I think it's interesting, the whole psychology of people and persuasion. And that's why I was glad that that Frank introduced us. So can you share with me some specific people that you've worked with, you know, without, you know, getting too personal with information, you probably can't.
Yeah. If people look on my website, you'll see a long list of like insurance companies and insurance agencies. So, I mean, like I've been working with Westfield Insurance and Grange Insurance.
Do you coach with individuals or is it always really like group settings?
The majority of the time it's group setting, because a lot of times when an insurance company, for example, reaches out to me, usually they've got a sales team and they're looking for ways to optimize their skill set when they're walking into that independent insurance agent's office and competing for that shelf space and trying to get their fair share of business. I do a lot of one-on-one coaching, and that can be a variety of individuals. I've had, financial planners, because they really recognize, you know, their ability to talk to that client, to help them make those financial choices. I've worked with small business owners, for example, in like mortgage industries. And so just a variety. And that's usually where somebody says, I don't have time to go through a 2-day training, but I have some very specific needs. And I would like you to one-on-one teach me some of the psychology and help me clearly see how to apply that. So it's a, I'll call it a quasi coaching / consulting. And then I've worked with lots of companies outside of the insurance industry. I've like last week I was a guest lecturer for Vanderbilt. I've spoke at Ohio State.
Sure. Yeah.
I've worked with UBS, Sun Life Financial, Bank First, just a lot of financial organizations too on that side, but just a variety. One of my clients was a hearing aid company, and just looking for ways to talk about their products and services in a more engaging way to get those people to go, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, let's go ahead and do business.
Sure. When you're talking at the universities, are you talking to business students mostly?
Yeah, the like the Vanderbilt students were graduate level students. One of the times it was a marketing class down at Ohio State, but then there was another time where it was a psychology class.
Oh,
the psychology class was really interesting because these were graduate level students. And what really stood out to me is they really understood the psychology, but based on their experience or not having a lot of experience yet in the business realm, they didn't always see the practical application.
Right.
And so you can sometimes get that academia view, and then you can sometimes have this practical that doesn't rely on any resources, any science. I like to see myself as the person in the middle. I love reading about it and learning, and I understand business, and I can be that transitional person.
Yeah, you're connecting
to help people figure it out.
That's what I was asking, because if you take a student, even in business and marketing, they have no street experience, right? So mm-hmm. they've never really been in a situation where they're selling to people or having to sell a product or, you know, whatever. And I'm just curious as to how, I mean, there's no way to know, but you wonder how they receive that information. You know, it's very easy if you've been in sales for, you know, 5 or 10 years, and then I meet you and everything you said makes sense because it starts basically connecting things in your mind.
Right.
But when you don't have that other piece, you know, you wonder if it's like you said, your daughter, where you forced her to read that book. It didn't really hit her till later on. And,
right.
you know, life experience has a lot to do with how you absorb things. I'm sure that if I know what I knew, what if I knew then, say when I'm 20, what I know when I'm 55, you know, you always say you'd be so far ahead in life or whatever. But maybe I wasn't in the mental frame of mind to accept it, to digest it, to understand it.
Yeah.
Here's a word from our sponsors. Uplift your marketing and reinforce your brand with a digital business card from Digital Accelerant. Use a text marketing combination to stand out in front of your competition. Digital business cards make you memorable and most of all help you bring in new business through its warm lead generator. Motion graphics, intro, outro, and inspirational videos can be added during setup. Text the word LAW to 21000. That's L-A-W to 21000 to learn how to get your own digital business card. Suffering from slow internet speed? Worried about hackers? Fetch Pro gets the internet from your smartphone to your Windows and Mac computer without paying for a hotspot. Always get the fastest, most stable, and secure internet access on your computer with Fetch Pro. Follow their affiliate link on our website to learn more and get connected with Fetch. Printify is the online service that simplifies and automates the process of sourcing and creating print-on-demand products branded with your company logo, product, or service. Printify is a better alternative to pre-purchasing and warehousing your merchandise for distribution or sale. Follow their link from our website to learn how to set up your own online store. And be sure to visit our online store and get yourself some podcast merch. Follow the link in the show notes to learn more about all of our sponsors. And now back to our show.
I would have liked to have been exposed to it, though, because I think I would have started connecting the dots quicker.
Sooner, of course. Yeah.
For me, though, what I do think about when I was in college, you know, of all the courses that I took, one that really stood out was a Psych 101. And I don't remember a lot of the details, but I always remember the professor saying, when it's cold outside, you know, my wife will say to our 5-year-old boy, put your mittens on. Of course, you know, that's the parental thing, right? You want their hands to be warm. You don't want them to get frostbite. But of course, a little 5-year-old boy is defiant. And he says, no.
Right.
And the prof said, when I would approach him, I'd say, oh, it's cold outside. Are you going to wear your red mittens or your blue? And that little boy would go, blue. And,
right. Because you give him a choice of not doing, but which one do you want to do, right?
Yeah. And it's such a simple thing. But I would say the majority of parents never do that. They tell their kids what to do. Or rather than giving, you know, structured choices when they wake up, like, hey, what do you want to do today? Do you want to go to the library for reading? Would you like to go to a movie? Or do you want to go over to the mall? Whatever. And they'll usually choose one of those three. But if they just wake up and you go, what do you want to do today? And they go, I want to go to Disney World. No, we're not going to Disney World.
Right. Now you're already negative. Right. Yeah. Definitely parents are not good at persuading their children because they don't feel they have to, right? You feel like, well, your kid ever say to you, well, why? Like, it doesn't make sense to them. And you're like, because I'm the parent.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a good answer to your kid.
and unfortunately, that bleeds into what we do at work. And so one of the other principles that I talk about is called consistency, which says we feel this internal psychological pressure, but also external social pressure to be consistent in what we say and what we do.
Right.
So if I ask you to do something, Mitch, and you say, sure, I'll be happy to do that, you now feel this internal pressure to follow through, plus a little social pressure like, oh, Brian heard me say yes, and yeah, you don't want to be bad. That is a powerful motivator. But if I tell you what to do, you are not nearly as likely to do it because you haven't committed. You're not right, feeling internal pressure.
Right.
And sometimes people will say, well, I'm the parent and I don't have to ask. Okay, go bang your head on this.
Good luck with that, right? Yeah. I know. No, long term, that doesn't work. You just get a frustrated kid. And I think you're right. There's a big difference. I was on a show about leadership and being a good leader and the development of, there's a big difference between being a leader and being a dictator, not in the political sense, but I'm saying in terms of you either dictate something or you lead people along the path, and good leaders don't dictate and tell people what to do because it never works.
Well, I mentioned that my dad was in the Marines, right? When you are serving in the Marines, people are barking orders at you, and somebody might go, what's the difference there? And the difference is this, that my dad knew that whoever he was next to would die for him.
Right. That's the thing. And if you didn't follow orders, other people could die as well. But it's a different system.
In business, when you get that boss who barks orders, you're not looking at him going, yeah, but he'll die for me.
Yeah,
or he'll die for me. Right. No, you're just thinking, what a jerk. And any opportunity you have to move away from that authoritarianism, you will do it. And so it takes, to be a good influencer, it takes first and foremost change within you, because you will have to break the patterns that you've grown with. That authoritarian, I'm going to just tell you what to do. No, I'm going to step back and I'm going to ask.
Good advice.
Sometimes people go, yeah, but what if they say no? Well, there's all kinds of other psychology that we teach.
Right.
You set up the ask so that if you say no, you've got fallback position.
Right. You got somewhere to go with that, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. If you just put it down and say, this is what we're doing, they say, well, we're not. And then what do you do from there? And you're right. That doesn't lead to motivated teams. It doesn't lead to people buying into whatever vision you have of running your company or being successful, or people that are out there selling that treat. I remember when I was working, I think it was Nationwide. I was working in their home office and we had either life insurance. It was the wholesalers. I think it was annuity wholesalers. And there was this one guy who was the best of the best. I mean, everybody knew him. He was later in his career, but he would sell more through his network, whatever, than anybody in the business. So there was some management change or something and they cut the commissions. So basically when you would hit a cap of commissions as to the most you could earn, which is a stupid, right? So this guy would stop working like September 15th, October 1st. And the manager would be like, well, why aren't you, what's this guy doing? I go, well, he's not making any more money for the rest of the year. So why the hell is he, you know, because they just looked at it. They didn't look at it like, well, nobody's going to hit those numbers. Mm-hmm. He did pretty early on. And then he had no motivation to support the organization because he said, well, that's not supporting the company. I said, he doesn't care. He cares about his lifestyle and what he, you know, he's selling. They'll buy into your dream, but not if you don't pay him for his work.
Well, there's a lot of times where the sales mentality can be very different than maybe somebody who's in underwriting or management or claims or something like that. They are motivated by different things. And when you have people who are not of that mindset trying to structure incentives, it usually doesn't go well.
Right.
I remember somebody at one of the companies that I worked for, there was a bonus plan that was in place and it was a quarterly bonus plan. And it was so heavily weighted toward profit that people started to figure out, even if we don't grow at all, we can get a much better bonus check if we're super profitable. And in the insurance world, that could mean just re-underwriting your book of business, continually peel off stuff that's not good, but no incentive to go after new stuff. And some people in certain offices were getting huge bonuses. And I remember one guy from an office who, they hit their sales numbers, they hit their profit numbers and everything else. And they go, what's the point? We should just, you know, stop.
Play the game the other way. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the senior managers said, well, I hope nobody would ever do that. You're not living in the real world.
Right. That's people's nature.
Yes.
They're going to play the game the way it's set up. And I think you're right there. I mean, I guess in that situation, you could maintain your profitability, improve your profitability without growing the book of business. Right.
Yes. And ultimately, that's not a good long-term strategy because your base, your revenue base isn't growing and all of a sudden expenses are going up and then you're out of whack in terms of a number of things. You know, to the self-interest, there was a leader who used to work at our company, and this is a great saying. He said, self-interest isn't the only horse in the race, but it is the one to bet on.
Right. That's for sure. That's for sure. I've never seen a situation where people act completely altruistically against their own betterment. You know, mm-hmm. people are going to act because they, you know, they want to take care of their families. And look, even government monies and stuff, people are, you know, people like, well, if I don't take it, somebody else is going to get it. Not, you know, and they take advantage of the different situations. And it's, but that's up to, right, the leaders of the corporations, of the businesses or whatever, to put structures in place that incentivizes people the right way to still have them buy into the, obviously there was a problem there, right? They got, they wanted to grow their book of business, but they set up a structure that didn't really incentivize people to do that. Yeah, definitely took the incentive out. It's funny because when I came out of law school, my father's been in the life insurance business since 1965, maybe long time. And I was coming out of law school and I felt that I was interested in like estate planning and business planning, all the stuff I do now. So, but I felt that I had no sales skills. Like I didn't, you know, especially in those days, you know, I came out of Cornell, economics and finance major, and there were no like entrepreneur courses. Now there's curriculums, right? So I can't, and I knew from growing up with my father who would take me to industry meetings, I'm sure a lot of which you've been to, right? From Million Dollar Roundtable to AALU to all those meetings, that it appeared to me that the best salespeople in the world were in the insurance business, right? Because it's the hardest stuff, like you said, to sell. Everyone needs it. Nobody wants it. You want it, but you don't want to use it. Sometimes you wonder why you have it, but you have to, you know, you can't just walk around with no protection. So I started studying with these guys and I came out of law school and I said, you know what? I'm going to go to an agency. My dad had most of his career with Mutual Benefit Life. Remember Mutual Benefit Life?
I was always on the property casualty side, so I'm not as familiar with the life.
The life side. So this was one, you probably remember when there was a big shakeup in the insurance industry. There was some California company. There was a couple of companies that had strung themselves out in terms of their asset investments of it. So this company was in Newark. It was a great company. It was a small company. And they hit the skids around when I was coming out of law school. So this agency, I think they went to Mass Mutual, but they were known for like bringing in young people and training them and running a really good sales program. So I, instead of going to practice law at the time, went into the insurance business, got licensed, the whole thing. And I would, you know, do these training things and meet people like you who were like, you know, and I'm better than most lawyers. I'm certainly not the best, you know, influencer, but it certainly made me cognizant of, you know, what's going on. But that was the road that I went down when I started. It was like sales training. They don't teach that in law school.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what they teach in law school. They don't teach you how to practice law. So,
well, it was interesting that one time many, many years ago when I was reading Robert Cialdini's book, which is called Influence, Science, and Practice, my sister-in-law, who used to be a litigator, said, "What are you reading?" And I told her, and then I said, "Well, you know, you learn this in law school, right?" And she goes, "We don't learn any of that. We just learn the law." And I'm like, "But you're a litigator. And so you are trying to persuade judges, juries, opposing counsel." She goes, "No, we don't learn that." It was like trial, you know.
You go to moot court. You go to watch trials. There's none of that kind of training in terms of courtroom. And I don't do courtroom work, but none of it.
The sad thing about attorneys, though, I've done some work with like the Columbus Bar Association, the Ohio State Bar Association. Continuing education credits, be they in insurance or in the field of legal, it's important, right? We want to push people and make them stay current and things. But the downside becomes, once those structures get set up, I've literally had attorneys go, "I saw your course and it looked really interesting, but man, it's expensive compared to these other ones." And I go, "You know what? You get what you pay for."
Right.
Because I'm going to teach you something you will not get anywhere else. But I don't get to talk to all of them. So a lot of them look at it and go, "Yours is twice as expensive as this one. I'm not going to go." And the downside, Mitch, is I have sat in on some CLE courses where probably very, very smart attorneys, but they don't know anything about teaching.
Right.
And that teaching is in itself a skill set.
Oh, my God. Especially the video ones where, you know, the guy comes to the mic and he's like, "Today we're going to talk about, you know, municipal court." And but you have to listen because you're required to get your credits.
Yes. And you know, I was sitting in on one and the guy was talking about, you know, if you're not asleep yet, I'm like, what are you doing?
Right. You like, don't tell people that.
Yeah. And, yeah. And so I get why, if you've been exposed to that for years or decades, you're probably thinking, why do I want to pay so much more to go to this one when this guy's probably going to be like these guys? And unfortunately, right. It's not that way.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Well, you know, the whole continuing educational system, not just law, has become like a game. Like I didn't have to pay for it originally. Now I got to pay for it. I got to buy courses. So now they have these things where for, I don't know, $299, you can do unlimited courses. So you're just looking for things to like get through, to get the little code so you can get your certificate and said you did your continuing legal. But it might not be anything in the area. I mean, first of all, none of it's business development. Like that doesn't count. Marketing, sales, business development, running a practice, none of that counts in first continuing education, because I don't think it's educational enough.
Right. And then it's a challenge because you guys, you know, a lot of attorneys make a lot of money and they're going to go, I'm going to take a half day. That's a lot of money that I'm not making, that I am turning and paying. Yeah. So it's kind of like the incentive structure we talked about. Good intention to set something up to try to get people to take the actions that you want. But at some point, you also have to step back and go, maybe what we've created isn't necessarily in the best interest. How do we keep modifying it so that these attorneys know how to run a better practice, they're better business people, et cetera. It's the same thing in the insurance industry. And that's why insurance, I would never offer continuing ed, because I'm like, I'm not going to allow my skill set to get dumbed down to the lowest level, because I'm just so radically different than that. And the people who get it, the people who realize, you know what, if I can be a better salesperson, it will pay in multiples. So I don't care if I have to take more time off or if I pay more, because I'm going to learn a skill that will help me for the rest of my career. That's right. How we need to. I mean, just like when we invest money, we don't look at what did it do today? What's it going to do in 5, 10 or 15 years based on whatever my time frames are? That's how I have to view that. And many of the skill sets that we need to take the long view and say, how will this help me? Not just next week or next month, but for the entirety of my career.
Right. And not everybody's going to get it. You don't need to teach to the bottom and try and convince people that it's just not getting in their head anyway, no matter what you tell them. You know, they just look at the price and they don't get it. So, you know, you'll always be helping the 20% of the 80%, you know, the 20% of the 20%.
Yep.
But that's okay. There's plenty of those people. No shortage of, right, of people to talk to and groups you have to.
You know, sometimes people will say, oh, I can't believe, you know, like on a podcast, you talk about so much stuff, you're like kind of giving away your material. No, because too often people aren't going to do something with it. And the people who will are going to be the ones who are intrigued and say, I heard you on this podcast. I wanted to connect. Tell me more. And there's when you look at the entirety of an industry, there's still plenty of those people to keep me busy.
Yeah, no, I've had discussions even with other lawyers. Well, why would you put an ebook together about how to do this or how to do that? Then they won't use you. I go, those people were never going to use you to begin with, but you may run into somebody who says, you know what? I appreciate that I can do that myself, but I don't want to do it myself. This happens all the time. And then they call you or they refer you to somebody else. I mean, it's all part of the whole connection. And there's nobody who really puts out quality information that misses that point. Most people think like, why would I do that? I'm like teaching people not to use me. It doesn't work that way. Yep. It just doesn't work that way, you know, because they wouldn't have used it before. They're going to go to LegalZoom or whatever the crappy services are, you know? So do you do a lot of, you do a lot of stuff on Zoom now because, you know, traveling's more difficult and stuff?
I do. And so the setup that you see, I put up a video studio in my home because I knew that people were getting tired of the traditional, you know, face on the side and PowerPoint on the other side. And then somebody just talking to them. I'm sitting on a stool here, but I can get up. And so that's a 55-inch TV and I've got a lot of room.
Oh, that's not a virtual background?
No, this is a 55-inch
actual TV. Oh, okay.
And now the background that I have here, I can change them out. I get some things from Amazon. I can have a different.
Right. It's not always brick. Right. I got it.
But yeah, this is actually a 55-inch TV. I've got another computer down here so I can run a PowerPoint. But you can see because I'm standing, I can actually, this is almost like pre-pandemic that this person's really here and talking to me.
It's more engaging.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the audiences that I have worked with have loved it. I mean, they have really, really loved it.
I'll connect you with some agencies that I know. I know a lot of agencies because I work with a lot of insurance and financial professionals, at least in New Jersey, and they're always looking, especially now, they're probably, how do we connect with our salespeople? And they're all over the place. So I'll definitely connect you with with a bunch of them. I think you can bring them some value. So your books, I assume, are available on Amazon, right?
Yes. The first book was in paperback, ebook, and I did an audio. My second book, which is called Persuasive Selling for Relationship-Driven Insurance Agents, is paperback and ebook. I didn't do an audio because really its main intention was it supports a single-day workshop that I do. So I just decided not to go that route. And I will tell you, I'm working on a third book, which is called The Influencer, with the subtitle Secrets to Success and Happiness. And my first book was kind of a psychology-driven, and the next one was a sales. And there are some people who will never pick up a psychology or a sales book, but they'll read a good story. And so I wanted to try my hand at writing and say, could I really write a story?
So it's like a parable?
Yeah.
Like The Go-Giver, the way those are written?
Yep.
I like those very much because you can absorb, you can digest those very
and
easily.
And I know Bob Berg. Bob actually gave me a great testimonials on my books. And so I thought, can I write something in that genre? And I'm more than halfway through, but it follows the course of a young man from when he's born and goes to college. He learns a little psychology, and then he starts to connect the dots in the work world as he has a sales role, and he learns from coaches and mentors and bosses and clients, and he's just like formulating this philosophy of life, and it's all the foundation of it is the psychology that I teach. And I will tell you, Mitch, I've never had as much fun writing a book. You kind of feel like God. You're like, oh, what do I want this guy to do? I
can write anything. You're controlling his whole. I'm look forward to hearing about that. Please keep me on your mailing list. So the Influence People book, the first book, that's on Audible. You can get it on.
Yep.
Okay. That one. I'm going to get that because sometimes I'm driving around and I'm doing so many contracts and things and I can listen to it. I love it.
I was speaking at an event a few years ago and somebody had asked me if I was going to do the actual reading for that book. And they said this: you think you have a good voice? And my wife was in the audience and I said, I don't know, Jane, do I have a good voice? She goes, oh, it depends on what you're asking me. So I did end up reading that book and that was interesting too. I mean, I writing a book is interesting, getting it published, reading it, all of that stuff was learning for me. And I'm really glad I did it.
Yeah. Did you have to go into a studio for them?
I did. I hired a studio and it's tiring. I mean, I went there 2 days in a row, 4 hours straight. I mean, just reading.
You're reading the whole book out loud. That's got to take a lot out of you. But it's
And then of course you make mistakes, so you go back a third time so that you can re-record the bits, and then they pull everything together. It was a very, very interesting process. It gives me a lot more
appreciation.
Yeah, for when you read these audio or you hear these audio books. But you know, I do always enjoy it more if I'm listening to a book, knowing the author is the one reading it to me.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I listened to a lot of Malcolm Gladwell's books and it's him. It's kind of weird when it's not the author.
Yes.
You know, and then they talk in the third person sometimes. So it gets a little, but I digest books on Kindle, in paper, and, you know, on Audible. I got it all going at all the times. Plus Bob's been on my podcast too, because I had read his books a while back. And and then there was a book I read years ago. Have you ever heard of Referral of a Lifetime? It's a Ken Blanchard series type of books, you know?
I've not read it, but the name is ringing a bell.
Yeah, it's about basically keeping in touch with your clients, how to use, it's an influence book, right? How to build a keep in touch program, things like that. And originally you were sending out postcards. Now it's more digital, but it's 100 pages. And it's a story about this woman who goes into this coffee shop and meets this guy. And he says, you want to learn this? Come back. And she meets these different people along the way. And it's an interesting story and learns about all the different things that they're doing.
What's interesting about the book that I'm writing is it really is, you know, somebody asked me, is it about you? Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a little bit of me in there, but it's really starting to become kind of honoring to the people I've learned from because I start finding myself saying, oh, this character is based on Loring and this character is based on Al. And they, when I go back to them and say, hey, Al, you know, there's two chapters in my new book and you are the basis of that. He feels honored because it's talking about what I learned, but through the eyes of the lead character in the book. And that's been really fun. to look right, back sure. at my career and say, you know, who are these significant people? How can I weave that into this storyline?
Right. Well, that's why those kind of books are so well received, because they're not technical. You're not reading the principles and then, you know, you're reading a story, and the story is these people applying the principles and learning along the way, and you're kind of learning with them. I love the style, that type of style. So you'll have to, so you think maybe 6 months the book will be out?
Definitely before year end. I would like it to be by the end of the third quarter, because then it's available the rest of the year, especially as you go into the holiday season. If somebody reads and goes, oh, this is great, and they buy a copy for somebody else.
Right.
But I'm really, really excited about that. And you know, we've mentioned the name Bob Berg. I'm going to go back to Bob and let him take a look at it based on the books that he's written. And who knows, maybe I can persuade him to write a foreword or something right. like that. But he is an incredibly generous person.
He is.
The woman who is my book coach grew up with him and so made a connection with him. And you know, anytime you send that guy a message on LinkedIn or an email or whatever, boom, he's replying. I mean, he really lives what he writes about. I respect that.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. All right. So you had sent me a lot of links. So in the show notes, we'll put links for the books and your profiles and how people can get in touch with you. And obviously you're available for speaking and training and teaching and all that type of stuff, and they can get your book. So I want to thank you for giving me 50 minutes today to talk about all the things you're doing. And I hope this is valuable to people out there. If somebody's looking to, you know, improve the way that they talk to people and deal with people, not just in sales, I guess, mm-hmm. right? They should take a look at your materials and read. And can we put a link to Cialdini's book as well? His materials?
I can get you that information. Yeah, if you read his, and it gets very deep, and you know, he's a professor, it's very, very right. dense material, but it lays that foundation. And then I think when somebody reads my book, which starts building on it, you're like, okay, this makes sense now. And I learned this, but I wasn't sure how to apply it. Now I see clearly how to do that.
And how do you spell Cialdini?
Cialdini.
Not like it sounds.
No, Cial. Yeah, okay. Not at all like it sounds.
All right, very good. All right, Brian, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, and I hope you have a very nice weekend.
Thank you. You too. It was my pleasure.
If you like the podcast, please tell others about us. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Amazon Music, and many of the other podcast directories. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review, and feel free to share our episodes on social media. If you have any questions or comments, ideas for the show, or you'd even like to appear as a guest, reach out to us by email at info@beinhackerlaw.com. The Accidental Entrepreneur is hosted and produced by me, Mitch Beinhacker. If you'd like more information about my legal services, you can find me on social media or visit my website at beinhackerlaw.com. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe to our feed to be notified of all future episodes.